Eckhart Proy is with me. Good morning and welcome, Eckhart Proy.
Good morning. It's good to be back.
I know. And it's so funny because there's all of these levels of everything because you are still a resident of Spokane. This is your home.
I am. It's a great town to live in. Yeah. And it's also, it has a great airport. And that's pretty much the two things that I really need, and my family, of course,
and your family, and so you have been here, and yet you have not been here, and now you are very much here because this is such a great thing that I think this is really natural and healthy in organizations. When the beloved leader leaves, they hide for a while. I mean, I experienced that with the youth orchestra and that sort of thing, and then some time can pass, and then a greater ease can happen, can't you?
I think it is really important that when you step off the podium that you really step back and let the new music director make his mark. That was, of course, not easy because of what we went through in the past 2 years. But I think it was really, really important to kind of step aside and be invisible, to not interfere, even with just faint presence. And I have other things to do as well.
But I think
it is really important for the development of an organization that it really has time. It's like a new relationship that you don't interfere. And then, James Lowe is such a wonderful colleague, and I'm really, really grateful to be back because, you know, I mean, and I've said it many, many times that the Spokane Symphony has really made me who I am right now as a conductor. And so it's always nice to not come full circle, not quite yet, but just to check in and see where the orchestra is and to do, you know, one of my favorite composers, Bruckner, with this orchestra, and we've done quite a few of his symphonies, and I think it's a wonderful Bruckner orchestra. But I'm really grateful for James to invite me for this occasion.
And within that brings us into so many aspects of the conversation that we're about to have. I'm only going to do one quick sidestep, and that was the one sneaky thing you did when you sneaked into the chorus of Beethoven Ninth. Didn't you do that?
I did.
Or am I outing you?
No, not at all. No. So that was actually Christmas before the pandemic hit. Yes, or New Year's. And our resident conductor Morihiko Nakahara conducted that concert with Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. And I've done, I think, most if not all of the previous performances since we started this kind of Spokane tradition. Yeah. Many years ago, and I found it had become also part of my tradition, you know, to celebrate New Year's Eve, and I figured, you know, I've spent so many hours with the orchestra, but also with the chorus, and with Morihiko, who was here before me. So we go way back. We have a lot of history, and I knew that he would not feel uncomfortable with me being there, and so I love singing. You know, that's how I got into music since I was, I don't know, a baby, and so it was just fun to be on the other side. Yeah. You know, as a conductor, you usually don't have the opportunity to be on the other side, to either sit in the orchestra, to be in the chorus, to be on the receiving end of what is being conducted, and I always find it very enlightening and very joyful and very enriching to make music with sounds instead of just with gestures.
And so that was I thought that was a really sweet and cool thing, and yeah, so logical, because the last person one could imagine being hassled by that would be Morihiko. The guy doesn't break a sweat on so many levels his life.
We've been through so many things, and we've been really good friends and colleagues. And I cannot emphasize that, you know, enough. Conductors are lonely creatures because of our profession. That's only one conductor in front of a lot of people. And so you become not necessarily a loner, but you become very much independent of anybody else. So when you put two of these people, conductor creatures together, you never really know what's going to happen. But what I've actually experienced is that if you reach out, usually everybody's longing for this connection that musicians always have, because mm-hmm. they always play together. Singers always sing together, and conductors craving for that relationship as well with their colleagues, exchanging ideas, exchanging experiences, and I found that to be the case with both Morihiko as well as with James Lowe.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and again, if we're going to talk about personalities of people that just seem like wonderfully well-developed humans, that is certainly the case of James Lowe. Well, anyway, let's spend a moment talking about what you have done in the last 2 years, and then we'll come right back and talk about Bruckner and Wagner. But you've been way on the other side of the country, primarily. That's been your primary job in Portland, Maine. And they also, during the pandemic, were operating somewhat reduced and less busy, wasn't it? Describe kind of how you and that orchestra made it through.
So, being the music director of three organizations in three different parts of the country, I felt that I had, you know, a lot of kind of overview of what is possible and what is not possible, depending on where you are and depending on what the organization is like. I had an orchestra that didn't perform at all. I had an orchestra that performed only outdoors with mostly chamber music. And then with the Portland Symphony, they were pretty well prepared and had a lot of support, in financial support also, from their community and the board, and they went through all sorts of, you know, difficult processes to come to an agreement also with the union to be able to play indoors with a very reduced orchestra, with a social distancing, with masks, with plexiglass, you name it, all the stuff, all recorded. And it taught me a lot of things. A is, as soon as you have a mask on, your world becomes a lot smaller, and you don't hear well either. You don't think well. You don't hear well. You don't speak well. You don't smell. It says all your senses, and which is really, really amazing. Only because you wear a mask, all your senses are reduced. Of course, I'm very grateful to have had that opportunity. The other thing is, of course, when you play and you're surrounded by plexiglass, and people in masks, that the means of communication that we usually rely on, facial gestures, body language, it is so reduced that you have to compensate with something else. So actually, I think doing that, we learned a lot of new skills, and it was still artistically satisfying, to the extent that, yes, we made, well, good sounding music. Mm-hmm. It was not satisfying too much in the sense of, why are we making music? And you know, music is such a, not only music making itself as a process, but also playing for other people. It's such a social. It's music is really a social thing, and if you take that out, if you take people out of the picture, all of a sudden it's just sound making. And I think it makes it's the audience that really makes the music happen. Mm-hmm. So it gives you purpose to play. We can still play mm-hmm. without a purpose, mm-hmm. but if you have a purpose, you know, it's that little thing that makes all the difference. And so I think we've all experienced that mm-hmm. here in Spokane, but all over the world in the country, that once you start playing for people again, it's like it's this amazing thing that's happening again. And it's like if you find your taste buds, you know, it's like you can always eat food and it's good. Yeah, I eat it, but all of a sudden you have your taste buds back, and it's just this amazing experience. And so we went through all this, and it was well worth it, and especially also since now we don't really know what our future looks like. Still
mm-hmm. not. Yeah. Have you in recent months been able to have what we would call a normal concert experience?
A normal concert experience, but outdoors. Mm-hmm. So I was just recently with the Cincinnati Chamber Orchestra, and they basically decided early on, because of the unpredictability of the situation, that all their concerts would be outdoors. Mm-hmm. And that is in Ohio in August, in 80 to 90 degrees and high humidity. And so, but we had a live audience, and it was just wonderful, you know. But still, it's not the same as in a concert hall, because as soon as you do it outdoors, you have amplification to deal with, and also the physical distance between the audience and the orchestra.
Sure. And so we have a season coming upon us. You have yours in Portland, Maine, and we have ours in Spokane. And you're going to be coming back to conduct this orchestra in January in a concert of one really well-known Germanic work and one very unknown Germanic work, the Prelude and Liebestod, and then from Tristan, and then this Bruckner Third Symphony. First, just a practical question. What is the order of the concert? Which piece do you put first, and for what reason?
So, I mean, the Bruckner Symphony number 3 is, of course, the big piece of the evening, and that traditionally comes last, and I think that is a valid decision. So we wanted to open with something that relates to that symphony, and the Bruckner Third Symphony is also known as a Wagner Symphony, because Wagner had such an incredible impact, in its many versions that the symphony went through, like, I don't know, that's like 7, 8 or more versions of the symphony. At first, the Bruckner, the original authentic Bruckner themes are very audible, and then he kind of they faded more and more in the background. But Wagner had this incredible influence on Bruckner. So we're going to start out with the Prelude and the Liebestod from Tristan and Isolde, which is something that I always wanted to conduct and never got to conduct, because when we programmed it, I had to bail out of the concert. I was actually, I think, the only concert I ever bailed out because my daughter was born just that weekend.
That's right.
And Morihiko Nakahara actually took over that program. And so it has been one of these big holes, one of these big regrets of my life, because, you know, Tristan is not only a groundbreaking work, but it's so emotional, it's so beautiful, and it's so full of longing, and I can really hear now, you know, the orchestra pulling out all these lines and these chords and these and the crunch that it has, and this very, very, very deep emotion. So I'm really looking forward, you know, finally getting my shot at it. Yeah.
Lovely. So that will be at the beginning of the program. And now let's really delve in a certain way into the issue of Bruckner, because Bruckner is not universally known, loved, or acclaimed, and even there's various things said about him. So here's my long way of getting into Bruckner. Recently, the wonderful Exploring Music program has done a couple of weeks about Schubert. And often with Schubert and those great pieces by Schubert, they're all really long. And I've often asked people, especially chamber music players, how do you defend, justify, explain Schubert's use of length in writing these pieces? And so within that context, however you want to take this, how do you explain and defend Bruckner's use of length in his music?
I don't think you need to defend it. It's like you write a novel, it's going to be long. You know, it's just, if you want a short, sweet Mozart symphony, a Haydn symphony, then, you know, that is your thing. Short stories are great. But if you want to read a novel and you have this big book, of course it is effort to go through, and it will take time. But then at the end of that book, you are a different person, and that's, I think, what happens, at least to me, with a Bruckner symphony. And it's interesting that you mentioned Schubert, because Schubert is like the predecessor of Bruckner in so many ways. It reminds me so much of Bruckner, and it reminds me also of Schumann, who said about Schubert's symphony, heavenly length, you know. And it's not cynical. It could be, since it's German, it could be cynical, but it's not. Mm-hmm. It is really, certain things just take time to develop. You know, the landscape, the canvas that he paints just takes time. But I think also we're you know, focusing on length is not the right focus. I think it is really nobody complains about Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, you know, which is also an hour long. It's a similar length to, or actually exactly the same length as Bruckner's Third Symphony. And modern symphonies are much, much longer. Mm. You know, so but if you like big romantic symphonies with very, very powerful moments, then a Bruckner symphony is for you. And I think, you know, there's so many ways you can play a Bruckner symphony, and I think we always think there's the experience of listening to something really depends on the interpretation, and in particular when it's a piece that needs flow or that needs a certain sound. And so Bruckner for me is one of my big loves, and actually it's one of those composers that got me through the pandemic. And interestingly enough, and it always and actually through puberty too. So the arguably most well, two most difficult times in my life.
Well, we have the time to illuminate either or both of those things.
Yeah, no. So because for me, listening to Bruckner and also him, you know, it's one of the most human musical utterings. With his insecurities, with his belief system, with his all insecurity complexes, with the search for God, with his fear of death, and his longing for love, the unreachable, unfulfilled love, and all these very, very human traits, it's all packed in that symphony, over and over again. And so I could really relate to that as a teenager, and also in all these months of emptiness, you know, where I did not work, where I had no purpose, where I was just working in the garden for an hour, exactly like as long as a Bruckner symphony would be. And then I said, okay, I'm done. Flowers, I'm done. But I discovered so much while gardening and listening to Bruckner, because it's both are so connected to nature. And that's where I actually kind of rediscovered, or actually discovered, Bruckner's Third Symphony. I wasn't really familiar with it, and I found this. Everybody thinks, you know, Bruckner wrote the same symphony over and over again, which is not true. I think this is actually his first where he really found his way, his mold, and it's very different than his Second Symphony or his Fourth Symphony or so. It's much more dramatic in many ways, but it's so bombastic too. But it has this wonderful opener and these big gestures, you know, these question marks, demanding answers. And so for me, it's just a very human, you know, we always try to humanize composers. You don't have to humanize Bruckner. He was a very, very much a human being, and was in need of constant confirmation. You know, he had always had to fight off the critics. He was always belittled, and so he was always, you know. But then he had these worshippers. So he was God, and then also the little guy. But I think for me, it's very relatable, and I find his the way he writes extremely powerful, and it allows you coming back to the length. It allows you to kind of float away, and I think that is part of, for me at least, part of a good musical experience is not to analyze everything and sit there like, you know, I'm analyzing the Matrix for an hour, but at some point you got to let go. You got to let that go. You're on the mountain. You just take it all in, but you kind of let it come to you instead of you always analyzing. And that is, I think, that Bruckner allows you to do. He doesn't always bombard you with new things like Mahler or so. You know, it's like anything gets thrown at you that the orchestra has, you know, kitchen sink, everything. Bruckner doesn't do that. You know, he allows you the space, and you have just to calm down and suspend time. And that's why I kind of try not to talk about time when it comes to Bruckner or length, because time is suspended. And once you understand that this is a crucial part of this, then all of a sudden you just experience it. you know, and it could go on forever, but you don't know because time is suspended. So that's at least my kind of take on Bruckner.
So that's the experience we get to look forward to in January. Wow, what a treat! So it's what other you've done the fourth, and then you did one of the later ones too.
So we did the fourth. That was the first one. The fourth symphony is always the best and also most entryway into Bruckner, mm-hmm. I think. So if you have never listened to a Bruckner symphony, the fourth is the way to go. It is very picturesque. There's a hunt. It is very, very very beautiful. There's this big organ chords. It's great.
And you got great horn solos. Oh, what else do you need?
Wonderful. Then the next one we did was number 7, which has the 4 Wagner tubas, and it's just miraculous. And then we did number 6. That was the most recent one, which is also just a fairly short one. It's under 60 minutes. Yeah. And it's just this beautiful, instead of it sneaks in. It kind of draws you slowly into the symphony, and it's just a wonderful symphony. So we've done 3. So this will be my fourth symphony. And I always found that the Spokane Symphony has a great sense of how to play Bruckner. And I think that goes also back that was one of the first things I noticed when I became music director a long time ago, that Fabio Marchetti had done, I think, pretty much all of the Mahler symphonies, mm-hmm. and that this orchestra, in its DNA, has a sense of how to play longer works, how to sustain a big arch over, you know, a very challenging long symphonic work, and is not overwhelmed by just the sheer amount of music. And I think that is something that is very much embedded in this orchestra, even though, of course, a lot of personnel has changed. But the DNA always carries on, which is always interesting. You know, no matter how many musicians you change, the DNA of the orchestra is still that way, that it can totally master all these longer, very, very demanding orchestral pieces.
It's a fascinating but very true thing that you just said. I mean, you know, the one thing we've chosen to keep as a constant in radio programming forever and ever and ever is the Chicago Symphony. And I'm so intimately aware of it, including even one of our former bassoonists is now the second bassoonist of the Chicago Symphony, and the principal clarinetist was the last soloist we had before the pandemic and all that stuff. And then there's the golden age of the Chicago Symphony under Reiner in the 50s. And every Thursday night when I listen to it, I hear just a lot of commonality of things they do, of understanding note lengths and all kinds of things. That just happens, doesn't it?
It's interesting, and I think I'm sure there's research being done about what impacts a long-lasting change or addition into the DNA of an orchestra. How long does it take for a music director, for instance, or a concertmaster, or a horn player or so? Like these key people in the orchestra, mm-hmm. to make an impact that actually outlasts their personal presence. Mm-hmm. And how does that come out like years later? So it's like I made the connection between Fabio Marchetti and James Lowe. Mm-hmm. And even though I think, I don't know, more than half of the orchestra personnel has probably changed since Fabio was here. Yet I think his legacy carries still on. And I found it really interesting how these typical traits of the Berlin Phil or the Chicago, mm-hmm. or Cleveland, how these typical things that are introduced at some point are embedded in the DNA and then carry on even though the person has already left. You know, so it's nice to see generations that come after you know, these certain figureheads. And still carry on the same DNA that's still there.
We've all had these revelations. The bit of compensation for the pandemic, and you've already referred to a few of them. But just this understanding of what an orchestra is and does and why is a lot deeper now than what we may have taken for granted a few years ago. Don't you think?
I think that, because of the amount that we play and the frequency and all this repertoire that we just need to digest at a very, very quick, mm-hmm. pace, it is easy to, to be overwhelmed by it and forget what it's actually all about. You know, we always play well. But to experience why we went into the music in the first place. And I think that's kind of where we are now. It's kind of, we loved it as children because it was also new and it was this amazing experience. Then you get used to it. And then now we're starting all over again, become full circle and experience it like the first time. You know, it's this amazing experience that we haven't had in such a long, long time, playing for people. And so that's where I'm at, actually, kind of being reminded of how wonderful it actually is. Without having to always crank out new shows, you know. But of course, on a deeper level, and now I'm kind of thinking, you know, what is on my bucket list?
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually during the pandemic that I thought, when we're talking about repertoire, what am I going to do with the Spokane Symphony? And I thought, you know, what I really want to do before I die is to conduct all Bruckner symphonies. Mm-hmm. That was just something I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, this would be actually a really great meeting point with the orchestra, because it's somehow vaguely familiar. It's a brand new symphony. Nobody's ever done it. I haven't done it. And I think we can start exploring this piece together, you know, as like old hiking buddies, and we're going to go up that mountain together, not knowing where actually the top is, you know. And I think it would be and it will be a very exciting kind of experience, instead of going back to Schumann or Forst or something mm-hmm. that we have already mm-hmm. done, but exploring something new together. I thought that would be something neat.
We'll look forward to that exploration. Thank you, Eckhart Proy.
Thank you.
Eckhart Proy, whose concert will come along later in the season, I believe it's in January, that he will be doing that Bruckner Symphony. And a treat to have Eckhart with us back on the air and for that return concert. One of the many, many interesting ranges of the Spokane Symphony's upcoming season. This is Symphony Week, and the idea of Symphony Week is we certainly get words and ideas, but we also get music. One of the veteran symphony couples is two people who play bass lines normally in their time with the symphony, and that's the cellist Helen Byrne and the tuba player Leonard Byrne. They are with us, and they are finding common ground with a piece which was written originally for two tubas, and it was written by the composer whose composition is opening the symphony's season. That is the Black composer Adolphus Hale Stork. He wrote this piece, which you're about to hear, a sweet duet for two tubas called Springtime for Elephants. And he says that it represents an enthusiastic courtship. It's a two-part invention, appropriately enough for us, having started the morning with two-part inventions. So the two parts of cello and tuba. With us now in our studio, Helen Byrne and Leonard Byrne, and Springtime for Elephants. Thank you. Our studio, that originally tuba duet, and it just became a cello and tuba duet, played for us by cellist Helen Byrne and tuba player Leonard Byrne, and it is called Springtime for Elephants, and played and created by the composer Adolphus Hale Storck as a lovely little piece for that combination. Adolphus Hale Storck, who's piece is opening the Spokane Symphony Concert on Saturday night and then Sunday afternoon. And also another of his pieces, which is going to be played tonight at the Barrister Winery by the Eroica Trio. So a lot of the composer Adolphus Hale Storck. So we have you right here, and what a treat, Leonard and Helen Byrne. Let's start with you, Helen, and good morning and welcome, and thanks for being here.
We're really happy to be here.
And for playing that piece and picking it out, and then let's greet Leonard also. Good morning, Leonard.
Good morning, Vern.
And so the inevitable question of finding music to play when you have two instruments that you can either describe as too similar or too different. I mean, you're both bass clef
instruments. But they really don't go together.
Don't go together. It's a little tricky.
The color and the volume is just really hard to play together. But we have persevered over the years because we want to play together.
Of course you do. And later on, we can talk about these other contexts by which, among other things, Helen is a superb keyboard player, especially organist, so that's given you another outlet. But thinking of your orchestral instruments, what are a few of your other journeys you've found into duets to do?
Well, I mean, there are actually a few real tuba cello duets. Most of them really aren't all that interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What we've done otherwise is it's mostly been cello pieces. There's been some Offenbach and some other things. But in addition to trying to play with tuba, a couple of my other oddball brass instruments are a little bit lighter in tone. And so we've done things with me playing off a Clyde or my playing Serpent.
Right.
And it's easier to get the blend. It's still very much a broken consort, but it's, at least I'm not so loud.
Yeah, no, that would certainly make it a lot easier, but you have persevered, and I guess we don't have cameras available here, but the other interesting thing about Leonard and Helen is that there's at least 12 inches of height difference between the two of you, and so you're just good at reconciling things one way or the other. I want to really celebrate you and celebrate people who make music in Spokane with a little bit of origin story from each of you, and that's the time that I met each of you. I first saw Helen when she played and won the Youth Orchestra Concerto Competition when you were in high school. You took off, I think, to Northwestern University, didn't you?
I did go to Northwestern, and I was just terribly homesick most of the time I was there, and the Midwest was so boring. Yeah. So I couldn't wait to come home. And so I stayed and worked for a year in Chicago after I graduated, and then My husband at the time, Ben Fitch, who eventually became the principal oboist of the symphony, we sort of flipped a coin to decide which coast we would travel to. We ended up coming to Spokane.
So you kind of came to Spokane without an exact job and just
exactly.
to see if you could make your way here.
Exactly. And it turned out that just before we left Chicago, the Spokane Symphony announced the oboe audition. So we said, Helen is packing and Ben is practicing
sure.
and making reeds.
Yeah. And then, and of course, there's few oboe auditions, but there's more cello, not many, but a few
right.
more cello auditions.
Yeah, it took another year before there was a cello opening. So I just worked in Spokane as a typesetter, which is one of the things I had picked up at school. And
And then fast forward to the present, where a man, and we'll get there in our narrative later, where you're now the cellist of the Spokane String Quartet.
Yes,
so,
and that's been...
What a glorious thing.
Yeah, that's probably the thing that's keeping me playing the cello, because as you get older, playing instruments is more physically taxing. Things start hurting. But playing in that ensemble with those people... And the music is just so amazing for the string quartet repertoire is just glorious.
So. Yeah. And imprinted in my brain is the audition that Leonard took for the tuba job. I remember the audition very well because we didn't know this guy. He was some engineering student from the University of Idaho. And he came in and we thought, well, he'll kind of play a couple notes and he'll be okay. And then you just blew us away with all this great music making. Where were you in your life development as an engineer musician and coming up and taking that audition?
Well, the version of the story I do is I was down at Idaho graduating. I had a job offer for Pratt Whitney in Connecticut. And so I'd quit taking interviews because that's where I was going. And they rescinded the job offer at like the beginning of May or whatever, and Idaho graduates in the middle of May. And so now I didn't have a job offer. And Keytronic came in at the last minute to do interviews.
Yeah, I'll jump in and say you are right, number two or three in line on the whole planet of the digital revolution, right?
Right, yeah,
okay.
Yeah, pretty early.
Yeah.
And but we knew that there was going to be a tuba audition in Spokane Symphony that spring. I mean, those of us that played tuba and Idaho did. And a friend of mine was going to audition, my best friend in college. And so I'd been playing the audition stuff with him anyway that spring. And so when I came up here to do the interview with the Zirkles for my Keytronic job, I actually walked out of the interview with, I think it was Fred, might have been Lou, but I think it was Fred. So I could rush down to the symphony office to sign up for the audition. I literally walked out of my interview. Got the material. I did not own a horn, so I was using a borrowed horn from University of Idaho. Three of us engineering students got hired at Keytronic, so I was living in an apartment off of Lincoln on the lower South Hill, so we couldn't practice there. So after the 10-hour days at Keytronic, I would go to the apartment, grab my horn, go out to Eastern Washington, where, of course, I had no connection to whatever, walk in the back door, find a practice room with my borrowed horn from the University of Idaho, and practice. And for the excerpts, I would go to the Eastern Washington Music Library, where they had all the recordings at that time, and listen to recordings at the Eastern Library, which they would let me do on headphones, even though they didn't know me from Adam. And nobody ever bothered me at the library. Nobody ever even knocked on the door in the practice room. And so we finally came up to the audition, which was about a month after I had started at Keytronic, maybe a month and a half. And I went in there, and it was in the band room, which was a terrible place to play, terrible place. And played a pretty good, I thought I tried really well. My best friend from Idaho came in second. And I won the job. And so then I spent the rest of the summer desperately trying to buy a horn because I couldn't use the borrowed horn when the next semester started.
Yeah.
So that's where it started. I had actually played in an orchestra once before in my life. I'd been the tuba player in Huntsville Symphony my senior year in high school.
Huntsville, Alabama.
Huntsville, Alabama.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a couple origin stories, and here you are. And I don't know, then one of the many, many symphony couples, and we probably don't. People go to the symphony. You have to talk to somebody during the intermission. And so there's like a dozen symphony couples or something
right now.
There are a lot.
I bet none of them met being on the negotiation committee for the orchestra.
That's true. And, you know, that's an interesting thing because you really learn about people when you have to grapple with ideas, don't you?
Yeah. And stressful situations.
Yeah, of course. So, wow, yeah. That alone's great. So here you've been, you've both been in the symphony for all these many decades, but you've also contributed to the musical life of Spokane in so many ways. I know, Leonard, you've mentioned the other instruments because you've really been able to try out and pioneer some of the tuba relatives. Because the tuba is a really recent instrument in the orchestra, isn't it?
Yes, 19th century, mid-19th century is when the tuba was invented, 1830s. So, I just got interested trying to try a few other things. It's been fun.
Yeah. So
some of the standard music we play, actually, the parts say Uffeklied, and he will usually try to convince a conductor to let him do that, and mostly they won't because it's just not a big enough sound for a modern orchestra.
That's the thing. If it were an original instruments orchestra, it might be. Yeah, I think you've succeeded about two or three times. Yeah.
I've played Symphony Fantastique, played Midsummer Night's Dream several times.
Mm-hmm.
Eckhart, I think it was Eckhart, let me play Serpent once on Reformation Symphony.
Oh, fun! Yeah, so that's the Serpent. And the Uffeklied, for lack of just a crass description, looks like some strange sort of bell up bass saxophone only with a mouthpiece.
Baritone saxophone bent into the shape of a bassoon player with a trombone mouthpiece.
There you go. You're used to saying that. And so then the many other things, the tuba celebrations that you've started, because that is a disease among tuba players, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely the one in the summer. We actually started the Tuba Fest. It goes around the Northwest now. We do it like the week after 4th of July. Just recently, like 6-7 years ago, started doing the Tuba Christmas things and looking at whether or not we can do it again this year. We didn't do it last year because of obvious reasons, but it's fun.
Yeah. And so you've done those things. And then, Helen, like you say, you've been involved with symphony politics at one point and did that stuff. But what if some of your other, well, maybe talk about your organ playing. This is a fascinating side of you.
Well, when there was the principal cello opening in Spokane in the early 90s, I auditioned for that and I did not get that job. And that was fine, but I thought, well, I have nothing left to do. So I started taking organ lessons then from Janet Arend.
You had been a keyboard player as a child.
I started on piano as a kid. Yeah. My piano teacher was our church organist, and she wanted summers off, so she sat me down on the bench and turned it on and said, here you go. But I didn't know what I was doing. Oh. And so I had wonderful years of lessons with Janet, and I've been basically employed as a church musician most of the time since then. And it's the most fun thing I do.
Well, yeah, because you have all kinds of control and creativity. Talk a little bit more about the values of doing that.
Well, and right now I'm playing up at Manitou Presbyterian, and they have a wonderful pipe organ, and that's been just a real treat for me to get to play a real organ after all these years instead of, I don't. But we get to do lots of combinations of instruments. We bring in people, so you're always putting different things together, and it's never the same 2 weeks in a row, And if it's out of tune, it's not your fault.
Right,
so
yeah.
That's the best part.
Nice. And then also within the marriage relationship, when you make music together, because you go, dutifully go along, you're a member of the church choir, and occasionally get to play an instrument, and talk about your part of that, too.
Well, it's sometimes more than occasionally. Helen, when she has to have a special music thing and hasn't thought about it ahead of time, I often get a whole 24 hours notice that I'm playing a solo the next day. So,
but that's good because it reduces the amount of time we can fight about it.
That's true, definitely. And so it's a variety of instruments. And, of course, COVID, where we were doing so many things remotely, we were doing some of them actually up at our lake cabin. So the organ would be a pump organ we have up there or an accordion. And I would play one of the variety of instruments I keep stored up at the lake, and including alphorn. And so it was actually pretty fun. And I think the church people kind of liked not knowing what they were going to see when they turned in to the Sunday Channel.
Yeah, that was an interesting chapter in your life. Just a few years ago, for the sheer fun of it, you decided to learn the accordion too?
Yeah. I think it mostly started when we had Patricia Bartel play with the Spokane String Quartet. And mm-hmm. so I had dabbled before mm-hmm. that. But mm-hmm. so I took a couple lessons with down at her studio. And then we ended up being in an accordion orchestra that went to Victoria for a competition. So that was kind of fun mm-hmm. to be with a whole bunch of people who played the accordion way better than I did, but who had issues with reading music and following a conductor. So it was an interesting cross-fertilization for us.
And Leonard, also as the one of two or three working classical tuba players in town, there's that ever-evolving brass quintet. You change one player and rename the brass quintet or something like that. But talk about just a lifetime of brass playing in this town.
Well, brass quintets are great. I'm not currently in an active group except the symphony group that plays kids' things. But it is always, brass quintet literature is very interesting. Mm. And it's always an evolving situation on who's actually running the group and finding the jobs. And which is when you have the person that's finding the jobs and they move on or pass away, and you realize how important it is that person was that was finding the jobs, because even though you know where they are, nobody else picks up the baton and runs with it. We've had the same thing with tuba ensembles mm-hmm. where, you know, we'll be really active and somebody really wants to rehearse all the time. It's great, and you're out there rehearsing all the time. And you find a few things, and you have a library of things to play. And then when you don't have the person that's pushing, it's like, well, the rest of us are too busy, you know. It's
sure.
Unless somebody's pushing me, I'll rehearse mm-hmm. all the time. If then not, I'll be off doing something mm-hmm. else.
And as a brief overview, in addition to all of this, you've had a full career lifetime of a day job working in the evolving world of high tech. So you've had that full-time job while doing all this other stuff. Talk about that juggle.
Well, that juggle was really interesting, basically passed through the high-tech companies of Spokane. But I retired in 2001, which is quite a while ago now. Mm. Packet Engines being bought by Alcatel had been a good success. I didn't feel like interviewing for another job. And Symphony just gotten health insurance. So it seemed like a good opportunity. And that opportunity allowed me to do some other things as well, more music things, but also things like being instrumental in getting the Symphony Saray season started.
Thank you, because that's where I did want to end, because this is, after all, Symphony Week. And this whole idea of having a regular chamber music series within the symphony, we have about 3 minutes to talk about that.
Yep. I was very interested in having chamber music, both as a way to expand work for musicians, but personally, I had some pieces I wanted to play, and to have a venue and an opportunity, since I was never connected to a school, it's not like I could schedule my recital. And so the combination sounded great. And John Hancock, who came in as the manager, I had been working with the previous manager, and we were going to do something. Hancock really believed in it. And so, yeah, I pushed, I provided some money, but frankly, the Sorays wouldn't be here without John Hancock really, really believing in the concept and developing it actually much better than what I had actually proposed.
Yeah, but you were very much on that beginning of it, the chamber music soirees, which were in several different rooms throughout history of the Davenport, and then at some point at the Spokane Club and
Masonic Temple, and I think, Masonic and Temple. Also the Oddfellows. I think, but
and the other thing that's pretty obvious from my two guests is the gregarious and easy communicative ability that you both have, and I'd like to think that maybe Leonard, you were one of the instigators in the idea that the musicians themselves really needed to, out of their own personality, introduce the music and really make it real, because yeah. You certainly did that. Or you can talk about Leonard that way.
I don't think all the musicians appreciate it very much sometimes, but the audience really appreciates getting to hear from the musicians. And so I think even though sometimes we have to push somebody to talk, it's worth it.
I mean, it's part of the... Part of what we do on Sorays, but when we're doing brass quintets or when we were the two ensemble, I mean, you have to engage the audience. I actually really do believe in that. I think it works. And I have fun doing it at Sorays. Mm-hmm. I must admit, you know, after talking, you know, your brain's still swirling with the words, and then you got to go sit down and instrument and play. And
like it's a different part of your brain. It's
yeah, it is.
Hard to switch.
or if you're playing the music and then you kind of don't, you're kind of playing your music on automatic pilot because you're thinking of the next thing you're going to
say. Exactly right.
Yeah. So, exactly. Or what you wish you would have said.
Well, welcome to our world. Yeah. So there we have it. But what a treat. Two really significant musicians of Spokane, cellist and many, many other things, Helen Byrne and tuba player and many, many other things, Leonard Byrne, for all you've contributed all this time.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So that's what we did for Symphony Week today. Tomorrow we're going to go away from the Spokane Symphony and we're going to talk about and with some other orchestras and other musical possibilities. Then we'll return on Thursday and we'll talk about education. We'll talk about the Symphony Chorale and we'll bring in a percussionist. A mallet percussion player, Brian Bogue, who's equally veteran of the two people that we've been talking to illuminate his world and play some music for us. And then on Friday, we'll have the guest soloist, the violinist who's performing this weekend with the symphony, come in and we'll find out about her world. So another day of the Symphony Week. Thank you for listening.